can make a start. Good evening and welcome to this evening's programme talk at the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Natanya Rodovsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be a discussion on investment strategy for non-life insurers given by Simi Prakash of Ernst & Young. This talk will take place Wednesday the 10th of October and further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. Our next social event will be the SIAS welcome drinks on the 16th of October and then on the annual dinner on the 16th of November. Tickets are also available for that online, so please do visit our website. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on your way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get automatically added to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible, and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. So we'll email you a short online survey after this talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. And if the fire alarm does sound tonight, it's not a test, so please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. Finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around an hour and be followed by Q&A with the speaker. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talk, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to discussion from both student member of the IFOA and another from any fellow of the IFOA. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before asking your question. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so please do join us for that. Right, back to tonight's talk. This talk is based on the work of the IFOA Risk, Appetite and Life Officers Working Party. Our speaker, Rulof Kurse, is a South African actuary. He has worked in product development and reporting and been part of many first and second line teams. He came to the UK for 2 years, and that was 12 years ago. Rulof is passionate about actuaries using their skills in non-traditional fields. He loves travelling and running, and recently backed back from Patagonia in Argentina to the Rockies in Canada. He also brews his own beer. We don't have that tonight at the networking drinks, though. On that note, over to you, Rulof.
Evening, everybody, and thank you for coming out. If I'm a little bit tired-looking, it's because I flew back from Namibia last night and didn't get much sleep on the plane. And like any good actuary, I do mumble, so if you can't hear me in the back, please just raise your hand, and I'll try and raise my voice. Okay. So, first, the disclaimer. This is the standard SIAS one, just saying this is not their view. It's also not the view of the people that I work for. It's essentially the Risk Appetite Working Party that's presenting. So what are we going to discuss tonight? It's a summary of what our working party has been up to over the last few years. It's been a very interesting journey, and we're kind of in the wind-up phase of it, so we'll be making public whatever we found, and you are getting a little bit of a glimpse tonight of that. It's been a few years in the making, and it's been very rewarding working on this working party. It does have to fit around your day job and sometimes can be tricky, and there has been quite a few people involved that have rolled on and rolled off through the years, and I just want to thank them in advance for all their contributions that they've made to this. One thing I did want to say is if you do have a burning question, please just raise your hand and speak up. I'll repeat the question for the recording, and then we can have a bit more of an interactive session rather than all the questions at the end, if that's okay. So, why did I get involved with this? Like Natanya said, I am very interested in actuaries taking their skills to wider fields and applying what we do you know to other industries? And I thought that enterprise risk management and the associated risk appetites that go with that is something that we can take to non-insurance entities and fields. You know, people like Shell and BP have started employing actuaries and weighing up the costs and benefits of doing certain things there. And you know, we started in 2015, this working party, and it's been a bit of a ramble through the years, but this is a quote from our literature review, and it does sum it up quite nicely, saying why risk appetite is important. It forms a key part of enterprise risk management, and hopefully people are familiar with what that means. And it's not just insurance, but it is also starting to go into other industries, hopefully. So when we got together, there were lots of burning questions, and this is kind of a summary of what they were. Firstly, what does it mean, risk appetite? There's other things like, how important is it, really? We were quite curious to see if it is just a theoretical concept or if people are really using it. Are people able to link these risk appetites that they have, preferences, to actually creating value or at least not destroying value? And then how is that applied within insurers? Is it just, you know, a tick box exercise, or is it actually going into things like pricing, capital costs, etc.? Solvency II was very much in the news at the time and starting to be implemented. As I said, we started before 2016, so we thought we'd look at the risk appetite and different regulations and had a quick look at the Australian ones as well, but unfortunately, that was a few years ago, so if any of those questions do come up, I'll have to pass them back to the working party. And then also just to see how insurance companies do actually go about implementing this, which was, you know, a relatively new and exciting concept when we got going. What did we do to try and answer all these questions? Well, firstly, we went and read what is out there and did a literature review. And this is the things that I'm going to be discussing tonight. Then we went and looked at annual results that companies publish and looked specifically at the risk appetite statements therein. And I'll cover some findings from that as well. And then lastly, we tried to dig a bit under the surface and sent out a questionnaire, which various companies very kindly filled in, and we're going to cover some of the interesting results from that as well. So, on to the literature review. This is basically what we covered, and I'm going to be covering them over the next few slides, so we don't really have to spend too much time on this one. There's a lot of definitions of what risk appetite means out there, and to get some consistency within the working party, we debated and finally agreed upon what a suitable definition is for us. A couple of key things to pull out of this definition. Firstly, it's an authorized statement. So management gets involved, particularly the board, in saying this is what we believe our appetite is. It also sets a series of specific boundaries, and it is quite clear about what those boundaries are. It's clear and goes through the various levels of the entities, ideally. We'll come on to that later and see how successful people are, actually. And then the last part for me, which is important, is not to just consider the threats, but also to consider the opportunities and do the cost-benefit analysis of those. So as the definition says there, it's a threat and the cost of that control, or an opportunity and the cost of trying to exploit that opportunity. There's a couple of other things that are related to this definition and terms that you'll come across whenever you deal with these kind of risk appetite statements. So firstly, let's just start with the second one from the top there, so risk appetite. And it's not quite exactly the same definition as the one up on the previous slide, but it is consistent still. I think. So risk appetite here is defined as the amount of risk we want, limited by the amount of capacity that we have for that risk and ability to manage that risk. And very importantly, it's linked to our strategic objectives. So we believe that we can make money from assuming this risk, which is what most insurers do, or transferring this risk if we don't believe that. So if we go up to the top one, risk capacity is really how much of this risk we can take before we breach our regulatory limits. Risk appetite is what the management, how much of this risk the management would like. So if we think about capital coverage ratios, 100% SCR ratio, or you know, would be the risk capacity, though technically it's the MCR that means we go best, but risk appetite would be something like 120% coverage ratio. In all of these things, diversification is obviously very important, and that means you can take different risks together and still stay within those limits. We then express that in either qualitative or quantitative statements. Some risks are very easy to measure, and very explicit quantitative statements can be made. But sometimes these risks are not that easy to measure, and only qualitative statements can be made. And those are the risk tolerances that we set. So, and then very important is also cascading that down into the different business units and departments and product lines and all those kind of things. So we come up with risk limits. And what companies generally have there is either hard limits or soft limits. Soft limits is where you can move within. If it gets triggered, we start taking action to avoid hitting the hard limit. Once we've hit the hard limit, we start taking much more action and bring it back within the soft limits. Any questions about those interactions, or is that as clear as mud? Okay. All right. Governance of risk appetites. So who owns this? It's very important for the board of directors to be involved with this, and it's supported by the FSB paper that we used in our literature review that actually found that boards that approve rather than just being asked about it, really understand it better. And that means that the strategy of the company and the risks that actually get taken align much better. There is, in the questionnaire, some more detail about which functions actually operationalize these kind of things and who gets consulted and who owns it and who proposes it and who reviews it. So we'll come into more detail there. But in the literature review, this is probably the most important finding that we had. Make sure that the boards are involved with this. Why get involved with these risk appetite statements? Why not just blindly follow something? So the first bullet there is something I guess we can all guess, and that's to help manage risks. We know what our risk appetite is, we know which risks we want to take, and that makes sure that helps us manage our risks better. Also across silos, so companies not just managing within departments, but there's somebody centrally that can help see the risks in different places and how those complement or amplify each other. That links to a bullet lower down, and hopefully when an external event happens, we'll have a reduced impact. Not just to our policyholders, but also to our shareholders. And one of the things we'll see later is there's a number of people that are involved with these risk appetite statements. There's lots of diverse views on what is good for the business and what is good for the policyholders and shareholders. And balancing all of those is definitely one of the tricky things, I think, that we saw companies have to overcome. Second bullet there is maybe more of a wishful thinking still, and that's really about optimizing which risks we take. So helping to identify where the opportunities are. So what do we believe we can make money on, and how do we pursue those, and which ones do we believe we can't make money on, and how do we avoid those. That helps us optimize our risk-return profile and definitely improves the chances of achieving our strategy. It leads to other items. If we can run our business better, we can hopefully convince the regulator that we're good at what we're doing, and maybe they take a lighter touch. Or alternatively, the rating agencies believe that we can hold lower levels of capital and still maintain solvency in times of need. I hope you can read what's there. These are a couple of core principles that we found across a few papers relating to risk appetite frameworks. The slide and the next slide covers that. So I'll just take you through a few things that I want to highlight on these. Firstly, development. This is not an easy thing to do from scratch. There's a lot of people that need to be consulted, and I've worked in companies where there are very diverse views as to which ones we should pursue and which ones we shouldn't, and how this all fits together, and what is good and bad, etc. I've also worked in companies with small management teams who all share the same vision and could put this together very quickly and all agreed pretty much on which risks to pursue. So, diverse interests of parties. And also, in this, it's very important to get different views from different departments. I do believe us actuaries tend to only talk to us actuaries instead of going out there and often speaking to the people who are in the very first line selling and et cetera to then get those views and actually bring it back and then make sure that our models do as appropriately as we can reflect reality out there. It's very important that these risk appetite frameworks reflect the company itself. Is it really able to handle a lot of complex risks? Is it able to handle those interactions? Is the management familiar with all these things, or is it a young startup with people coming across from banking, and should different tools be used? Is it a more simplistic business where more simplistic tools should be used initially, and then those should be made more complex as the business evolves? Also, on the right there at the top, very important to get the top down and the bottom up, as I said. So go out there, speak to people, see what they believe, see what they think is important, and then try and align those. This helps avoid one of the pitfalls we'll come across later, which is making sure that all of these things stack up consistently. And that definitely is one of the challenges. It might take a lot of persuading to make people realize that what they've been doing for years and years isn't necessarily the way to continue, but hopefully they will see the benefit of potentially doing something slightly different and how that links to shareholder value and policyholder protection. What else did I want to highlight on this? Definitely needs to express under features the preferences and the ones you don't like, the likes and dislikes. Otherwise, it gets even more confusing. Ideally, risks should be measured. In the bottom left, we can see a statement saying, not all risks can be measured, but even for those, we should try and put some qualitative statements in place to make sure that we stay within those hard and soft tolerances that we are trying to come up with. The one that I found quite interesting is data, and it's often quite tricky to find the correct data for this, but where we can, we really should try and maintain the consistency between the data that we use to report and the data that we use to measure these risks on a day-to-day basis. Making those links not always the easiest thing, and I think personally I've seen quite a few times when it's been interesting to make those links and explain those links at least, but over time, as you evolve these risk appetite frameworks, they do become clearer and clearer. One of the things that is useful is using key risk metrics that helps focus people. There is a risk that those risk metrics are oversimplistic sometimes and that they don't always catch everything that needs to be, but they are a key tool that can be used. We can avoid the top line because in my slide writing I accidentally copied that twice. Embedding. So once we've agreed what this risk appetite framework looks like, what it needs to do, why we're doing this, etc., it is very important to cascade it through all the parts of the company. This is not just a once-off exercise. It's ongoing, and it definitely needs the support from the top. It fails if there isn't board support behind it, and in which case, the people that are working on a day-to-day basis wonder why why they need to toe these new lines or not. It needs to be consistent, and that's one of the trickiest bits, from top to bottom. Often that is very difficult, and that is an ongoing challenge as well. And then near the bottom, it should be reassessed. This is after significant events. We'll find in the questionnaire that we sent out to companies, that most companies actually reassess this on an annual basis to see if it's still appropriate or not, and whether there needs to be a change in direction or a change in preferences at least. And then the bottom right there, it should remain flexible. As the world changes, these things should change with it. It's not something written in stone, though we'd like to think so at times, and why should we keep developing it if we've put so much effort into it? But realistically, things move on, new risks emerge, and people, societies change. One of the interesting points there also is under embedding at the far right. This needs to be communicated externally as well, and a lot of the benefits that you get is actually by taking this outside and saying, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is what we're about, and this is how we are going down this journey. We're doing certain things well at the moment, and there are certain things that we'd like to improve, but making those things clear internally and externally often helps. Risks faced by insurers is something we also looked into. This is very much the Solvency II standard formula risks, so I'm not going to dwell on this too much. I think more importantly, on the next slide, is how do we implement this? And these are kind of steps that we found recommended by the papers that we reviewed. Firstly, go out there and see what all the risks are, and compare to the previous slide, which is mainly the quantitative risks from the standard formula. You should not just look at the quantitative ones. You should also look at the qualitative ones that you can't necessarily measure: strategic, reputational, group risk if you're part of a group, these kind of things. Then write it down. So let's start writing down what we like, what we don't like, putting numbers to it where we can, putting qualitative statements to it where we can't. Go out there, tell people about it, consult with the different departments, and keep reiterating that process. So communicate it, and at the bottom, probably not rather than step three, is maintain it, but keep communicating it. One of the easiest places to keep reviewing this is during the business planning cycle, or the ORSA process, which is annual processes, hopefully, depending on the complexity and nature of the insurer. Cascading here means driving it into people's everyday decisions, so giving them enough freedom to make the decisions that they need to, but also setting the soft and hard tolerances around that so that they don't overstep boundaries that might impact something outside the departments that they are in, the business units that they are in, which they may or may not be aware of. We've seen operational risks where traders overstep the line completely, and you know, that's part of the reason why these risk appetite frameworks, I guess, has gotten more interest across our industry. And then monitor and report it. So here, like I said, there's some key risk indicators that can be used. There's some qualitative statements that can be used. And you know, certain risks monitored hourly, daily. Other risks monitored monthly or annually even. It depends on the type of risk. But making sure that they stay within those hard and soft tolerances. There's a lot of challenges around these implementations, and I think what this slide doesn't cover is potentially changing cultures within companies, slowly but surely shifting from people having free rein to what can be perceived as tying their hands. But it is important to maintain that balance of freedom of choice so that people can pursue the opportunities that they identify along the way. What can go wrong? We like measuring things as actuaries, and often it's not possible. Group risk is an example. Strategic risk is something else that's difficult to measure. Other items, which is, you know, diversification, who do you allocate it to, these kind of things. So these appetites and preferences can result in difficulties in coming up with numbers. And it's that could lead to the next one where people get given the wrong targets. So they go and get a hard limit or a soft limit, and it hasn't been set consistently, and therefore results in suboptimal returns or dangerous practices that come back and haunt us a year later or 20 years down the line. Part of the problem is trying to be clear enough, but while still giving flexibility, and that could lead to vague expressions of risk appetite or limits. And getting that, again, consistency of view is another pitfall that could be a problem. That leads to not being able to drive it down into the various business units, countries, product lines, whatever the company wants to drive it into. And, you know, where we can come up with numbers, some of those numbers, like I said, could be oversimplistic and could not capture all the risks that are out there. One of the things is emerging risks. So it's very easy to monitor and measure the ones that we know about and have put soft and hard tolerances in place for. And then there's also the risk of not knowing what we don't know and how do we allow for that. So that's a risk of key risk indicators and over-reliance on them. And then the last bullet there is there's a lot of people involved with this, and some people may not have been consulted properly, may be left out, may not understand why we're doing this and you know what the benefits are of it. So as I said, some of it is actually doing some cultural changes in companies and departments. So the next thing we did was to go and see what companies have said outside in public space. So we went to the annual returns and focused on the risk appetite statements that companies published within there. It's not always, some of it is in depth, some of it is very high level, and we try to bring consistency in our evaluation of those, at least. So. One of the last things that I want to highlight before stepping onto that is from the literature review. What makes a good risk appetite statement? And these are the three. This is a good summary from CRO Forum. So it needs to be comprehensive, it needs to be practical, and it needs to be consistent. So what do those things mean? Comprehensive is it's covering all the risks that an entity has faced. And we spoke about the ones that are qualitative, the ones that are quantitative, the ones that are, you know, that we don't even know about yet. So going through all of those and trying to identify as many of those as we can. Practical, sometimes difficult to achieve, but companies have done the best that they can and what we've found. And then consistent, coherent, again, something that stacks up from top to bottom and from bottom to top and allows freedom where it needs to be and boundaries where it needs to be. So from the public statements that we looked at 15 annual reports and accounts and tried to see which of these items get mentioned in the risk appetite statements that are published out there. There's definitely a big focus on capital, as you can see from that, in that most companies at least mention in their risk appetite statements that they would like to maintain sufficient capital. These risk appetite statements in the reports and accounts are often four or five qualitative statements along the lines of we would like to maintain a sufficient level of capital, we would like to abide by all the regulations that are relevant to us and give our customers the necessary protection that, etc. Next ones that came in there, which is good to see, is liquidity. So we can pay companies when we need to. And I think maybe the 2008-2009 credit crunches were quite in people's minds when they wrote these risk appetite statements for the accounts. Earnings and customer or reputation risk also comes into it. But then the one that really drops off is strategy. There's a few companies that mention it, but it's not necessarily at the top of the list of these different statements. Defining earnings was also not something that's explicitly said. It might be IFRS, it might be MCEV, or you know, it might be something else. So again, there's different ones there. Capital. It also, some companies have different appetite statements for Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, or their own capital matrix. Okay. Flying through my slides. So what we did then is try to lift the hood and see what companies would tell us if it gets anonymized. So we drafted a questionnaire, and there was about 40, 45 questions in there that we sent out, often asking for a rating from 1 to 5 to try and make things easy for people to fill in. We got about 50 responses, and really want to say thank you to everybody who did respond out there. Some questions clearly were quite ambiguously still written, and we didn't always get answers to all the questions, but appreciate the answers that we did get. This went through the institute and faculty, and what came back to the working party was completely anonymized. So we couldn't see which company it came from. And they also very kindly turned it into a number of bar charts. So I'm going to take you through a couple of these bar charts now and then point out some interesting things that I think are on those bar charts. I will probably get criticized for not making these charts very interesting, but you know, I try to stay true to the source that I received them from in this presentation. Okay, so who answered? On the left, you can see there's a mix between mutual and listed, mainly private sector. A couple of composites, and then also predominantly UK-based, but also some global groups answered. You can see the distribution of the assets under management there. So quite a good spread between quite small insurers and then really big ones as well. Okay. So the good news. Most companies have that responded. have risk appetite statements. So that's a good start. Very few said no, and we can't see who those are, but hopefully since we sent this out last year, maybe that prompted them to go and look into some risk appetite statements and then come up with some. How do these risk appetite statements impact your day-to-day business? And I think what I'd like to pull out here is the two leaders. So definitely a big part of the AUSA process, which makes sense in that we go through what these risks are, which ones we like, which ones we don't like, which we have the capacity to handle, which we should develop the capacity to handle. There's a big focus on capital as well as in these risk appetite activities. And then I guess ones that I would like to highlight is the ones that are lagging, I guess, there as well. So value creation, one for one's hitting a lower score. Product development and pricing probably linked to value creation, so where are the opportunities that we identify through these risk appetite monitorings? And very low down on the list, which was a bit disconcerting to me personally, is remuneration, which hints at the fact that we're willing to chase certain risks, but our remuneration isn't necessarily linked strong enough to if that goes well or bad. Potentially that is one of the things that companies should really improve and address going forward. What do companies include in these risk appetite frameworks? So the ones on the left are very much Solvency II kind of stuff. You'll see operational risk on the right as well. So they all score quite well. What's good to see is companies also thinking about conduct risk and reputational risk. So those score quite highly as well. I'm not 100% sure why we split out fraud financial crime risk from conduct risk, but that gets a much lower score. Consistent with the slide above, new business also scores very low, and value scores very low, and earnings as well, which is interesting given that a lot of companies included earnings in their risk appetite statements. But then once they get to what they actually monitor for these risks, it seems that that doesn't translate necessarily yet. Group risk, given the respondents, it's natural that group risk wouldn't be there for everybody. Okay. So who has responsibility for what? And yeah, okay, that's big enough so you guys can read there. Very good to see that it's the boards that own these risk appetites. And that helps bring the benefit that the FSB mentioned, which is that they understand it better and that they can align it with the business strategy, hopefully. Who gets consulted? You can see there's a lot of green on that. So it is really going around the houses, getting everybody's views on all these things and making sure that it at least gets included in the risk appetites and risk preferences. And then whose responsibility is it to make happen? Well, it seems that it's the CRO who, you know, at least needs to come and write it down and propose it, often on an annual basis, and then also to cascade it down into the different entities. There's other stakeholders there as well, and not all companies have CROs, so it could be the actual function holder, it could be other specific people that get allocated this task. I think for me, the two main themes here is how widely people get consulted, and really good to see that it's the board that owns this. So it goes into the business, it gets aligned with the business strategy, hopefully. How do we set this? So essentially on this, it's a combination that prevails every time, which is good to see. setting it just top-down or just bottom-up means that consistency doesn't necessarily come across, and I was very encouraged to see that combination is what comes out tops every time. Okay. And then where do we take it to? It seems that business unit is the one that most entities take it to. Sometimes it can be harder to take it down to product lines, and I can appreciate that that might be the case. But at least it goes down to a local business unit. So from that point of view, consistency can be achieved between different companies within the same group. How do we set this? So stress and scenario testing, reverse stress testing. We come up with numbers, and then we push it back down. But there's also, in the middle, the debate. So the qualitative discussions around it. Is this really the limits we want? Is this really where we want to be? I found it quite interesting that we could benchmark. I wasn't 100% sure where those benchmarking industry data comes from, but I'm sure there's some consultants out there that are helping make that happen. And then the one on the right, which is quite good to see, is that using external assistance is very low. So it's actually the businesses doing it themselves and, you know, coming up with what they would like rather than getting somebody from outside to come and tell them what they want to do. There's some approximations there when, you know, precise calculations can't allow for it, and I think that's just being people trying to be practical and as they go along with this. How do people view the level of embedding? So one was where it is only the top management that knows about this, and five was everybody in the whole enterprise-wide knows about the risk appetites and preferences and soft and hard limits. And I think a lot of entities gave themselves a good pat on the back, believing that they are towards almost everybody knowing. And then various successes in, you know, benefits from this. So companies have managed to identify breaches and address those as they've been breached. And then what's encouraging also is the next one is that's performing quite well is informing decisions. So I guess trying to identify opportunities and helping people go after those. That links to the business plan. So, you know, we're monitoring these. We can see what's going well, and we can set our next 3 to 5 year cycle of business plan with these in mind, hopefully. What's interesting on this one is that either the boards are very good in that their knowledge can't be increased, or the wording of that middle one was a bit ambiguous, and boards' awareness weren't necessarily increased by all this risk appetite work that was done. This is my last slide, and then we can go across to some questions, hopefully. So what is going to be done? There's a lot of activity that companies still want to do. More embedding. The link to value creation seems quite high there as well. Better modeling on the far right. We can always fine-tune things with more numbers and more calculations. Optimizing it. Helping change the culture by getting buy-in. And then the one that is lower down the list is understanding the regulations better. I think this is because companies really make it, tailor it to their own situation rather than necessarily just what they're trying to do a tick box exercise, but maybe I'm naively hoping for that. And then one question we did ask about a year ago was, are companies changing any of this for Brexit? And that was a very resounding no, which was quite interesting for me, but I guess companies believe that they are prepared for any changes that come from it. Okay. And then I'm going to sit down and hopefully take some questions from the floor. Otherwise, we can make a quick exit to the wine in the back. Okay, thank you.
Okay, any questions from the floor? Remember to state your qualification status before you ask the question. You've got one at the back there.
Hi, I'm James, I'm a student. So based on some of the information there, do you think that upside risk is possibly being ignored a little bit more than maybe it should be compared to mitigating the downside risks?
Potentially, yes. We got some encouraging answers there saying that it's being looked at least. But yes, I think also, you know, from experience where I've worked, not necessarily just from this risk appetite working party, a lot of companies feel that it's a constraining measure rather than an upside identification tool as well. Big part of that is what diversification can be achieved on capital, and often it is expertise that's been built up over years and years and not necessarily being able to identify the next set of opportunities out there. But yes, I do think that there's more work that can be done on achieving the upsides from this. And again, maybe it's my naive view, but I do believe as actuaries and potentially as CROs, that is one of the tasks or that we can help companies with. And it's not just the CEOs and the CFOs that should be looking at the upsides, but CROs and risk functions that can help with those as well. Yeah, thanks.
Hi there, Paul Simmons. I'm not a student.
Okay.
Are you able to give any insight as to who answered the survey? I'm sort of mindful that if you ask the CRO how well embedded the risk appetite is into the business, then you're probably going to get a fairly positive answer. Whereas I think it might be more interesting almost to ask the CEO, you know, what value does risk appetite bring when he's running the business?
No, we did not. We do have some email contacts at the end, which was not anonymized, but whether those are the people that actually answered it or just put, you know, got handed over to say if there's more questions, please come back to these guys. That's a very good question, and I do agree with you that if you were to ask different people different views, they would express different views on this. Maybe there's one to go back with and just maybe, you know, have a shorter questionnaire for the CEO, the CFO, COO, and say, you know, here's five questions. Do you think this has added any value? Do you think this has been embedded in your teams? Those kind of things. But yes, very true. My guess would be that it's mainly the second line, the people who are more familiar with these risk appetite statements and frameworks and have been doing the work in embedding it, that would have answered this. But that's probably just a natural way that the questions would be sent out within companies.
John Spain Fellow, I think upside risk used to be called reward, but never mind that. Have you come across any reflection of system software being taken into account risk appetite frameworks? I'm thinking particularly of a bank like TSB.
Yes, firstly, it used to be called whatever. I agree that these terms keep changing, and that's one of the reasons why we try to come up with what we believe these things are, just to maintain some consistency in how we wrote them down and asked people about them. But yeah, I completely agree that often terms like risk limits and tolerances and appetites and, you know, all these things get interchanged. So, yeah, I take your point on that. Regarding systems and IT, we didn't specifically ask whether there was how important operational risk or, you know, people, systems, etc. was for specific companies. It's not a question we specifically addressed, though within these risk appetite frameworks, there would hopefully be controls around those and would be monitored how many complaints come through. And once those go red, as an example, it could be seen, you know, dug into what is the source. Is it because the systems are not up to scratch and how urgently we need to address those? One of the in the literature review, it is also about addressing risks in a timely manner. So once they start spiking, making sure that they get handled in an appropriate manner. TSB obviously is in the news at the moment, and that's a big reputational and financial damage for them. So yeah.
Any other questions?
There's two.
Stuart Hicks Fellow, but it's hardly worth saying that. When is the Working Party hoping to publish something? What sort of timescale? I'm not asking you to say it's the 5th of October. Yeah. As you're next.
As lead of this Working Party and trying to wrap it up and trying to share what we've found, I would have liked to have published 6 months ago. But at that point, I was happily in Mexico. But realistically, I think we really want to wrap it up during the next 3 months and share with what we found. It might not become an actual paper, which has to go through a long process, and it might be the three different pieces that I've spoken about, which is the literature review itself, what we found from the annual accounts, and then the anonymized questionnaire, so that people can then dig into it themselves as they wish. So hopefully within the next 3 months.
Are you going to put these slides on the web as well?
Yes, once I've removed the typos that I've spotted today. Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks. Actually, this is building on the question earlier from the gentleman there. Apart from systems posing risks, have you, in your research, have you noticed people using new technologies like artificial intelligence, anything that's out there, to minimize risk? Is that something that's being actively used in the market? To look for fraud detection, I don't know.
Sure. Before I answer, can you just state your name? And
Oh, yes, okay. My name is Chan Zoran, and I'm a fellow, but from the Australian Institute.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, that's not something that we dug into, and I think getting examples of how companies manage it would require a lot of willingness to disclose what they do, whether it's visual or reports or not. I can speak from experience in that what we've helped companies develop has been generally trying to have quite short, let's call it 3 or 4 slides, that can be digested by senior management and board level. And often, because you only have so much space, those tend to be quite visual, with space for commentary next to them where needs to be. The commentary is often on exception, or, like I said, with these, just pulling out specific themes from the numbers that you're seeing. But that is not something that we had the capacity to go around and ask everybody, and I would think that companies wouldn't necessarily want to share that kind of information too willingly, given how much effort they put into it and trying to hopefully make some money from them monitoring. There's another question again in the middle of there.
Hi again. You mentioned at the outset about your interest in kind of seeing actuaries working in outside of their traditional actuarial fields. Mm. I was wondering if you, I'm very conscious that risk appetite and ERM frameworks are very much a concept at home in the financial services industry, Insurance and banking. I was wondering what examples, if any, you had of applications of risk appetite outside of the kind of traditional financial services space. I know you mentioned Shell and some of the oil majors earlier.
So they're anecdotal examples. From my notes many years ago, I know that there's interaction with engineers and trying to drive it into building industry. My dad being an engineer, we've often spoke about examples of what risks they take and how they stay within tolerances. I gave some advice there, though I'm not sure whether it ever made it into the escalators and elevators that they put in. Off the top of my head, not many. I'm still looking for those. I do know about companies, rating agencies is one of the, I guess, less traditional actuarial fields where there is more actuaries going into now. Outside of that, not many. Do you have any that you'd like to share?
I put you on the spot there. Apologies for that.
No,
my experience is, well, not particularly directly, but simply from a family connection. I've got a brother who works in the mining sector, and they're very much of the attitude that, you know, just don't let things go wrong in the first place, and that's how you control your risks. Mm. But much more so, we're seeing that because miners obviously have to take out insurance to look after themselves, that they are getting driven towards taking on more of this ERM-type framework to manage their risks and avoid having the losses. So I don't have any clear examples, but I can see there is evidence of it now going outside of the insurance and banking space.
It's very encouraging. Good, thanks.
Any other questions?
Stuart Hicks again. If you look at listed company reports, I think an awful lot of them, and I'm thinking of the transport and food and drink sector, where obviously a sort of reputational risk of accidents in the different ways comes to fore, but there's all sorts of other possible reputational issues that can go on, and group issues. A lot of them devote quite extensive amounts of paperwork to the risk frameworks that they've got in place. So yes, it is extended in a big way.
Sorry, I missed the last bit.
Yes, it's extended in a big way.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Of the 50 or so respondents to the survey, were they all life officers or were any of them general insurers?
We had a couple of composites. I don't remember whether I actually did get specific general insurers, but we definitely did have some composites. There is a slight higher up, which breaks it down, and I don't think there was a bar for general insurers specifically there from the respondents, which is a pity because we have somebody working in risk in the frontier, and I think it is something that general insurers also use, so it would have been good to get those views as well. Having spoken beforehand, it seems that general insurers have a lot more movement, whereas life insurers tend to look over the next 40 to 60 years, and that allows a stable risk appetite framework to be put in place easier, and maybe general insurers would really benefit from, well, you guys seem to do it anyways, you just didn't answer the questions, I guess.
So. Yeah, I would say in a general insurance environment, you have the same kind of framework set up, but the frameworks, like you said, there's just a lot more movement across it. One of the things we, for example, were doing, what I've seen in the general insurance industry is that when you've got your risk appetite set up and you've got a capital adequacy attached to that, that may be something that you'd probably review more regularly. And you'd also look at emerging risks more regularly. I mean, especially with general insurance, you've got so many things to cover. You're looking at emerging experience for a general insurer would be anything from 2 years up to 10 years from now, which is a lot shorter than the life insurance risks. And you'd be looking at things like emerging vehicle technology, alternate modeling techniques, cyber risk, those kind of things that are emerging. Probably from a life insurer's point of view, it would be short term, but from a general insurance point of view, it's more long term, but yet short enough to take account of. So I guess just a bit more movement, but the same kind of frameworks. And a lot more monitoring of the risk appetites to ensure that it's embedded throughout the business. John, I know an example that you were talking about was the Lloyd's TSB failure. And I think that's probably an example of their controls failing. And I know one of the things I've seen across the general insurance industry is just monitoring of the controls framework to make sure that the controls are still fit for purpose and are able to pick those things up sooner. Any other questions? Okay, excellent. On that note, thank you for tonight's talk. I hope, you know, we've all taken something away on risk management. or at least a bit of what the market does. Thank you once again for your participation. And then I've got two champagne prizes to award. The first one goes to James, the student who asked a question about upside risk being ignored. Good question. Thanks for that. And if you can come up and collect your champagne afterwards. And then we've got another one that goes to Paul Simmons, not a student, on the question around different people having different views and how that's embedded in the questionnaire. So well done to both of you. And then just a reminder to all of you to complete your online surveys if they come through tomorrow. We really do appreciate the feedback, and join us for networking drinks afterwards. And then if we can just thank the speaker in the usual way.